Welcome to this week's episode of the First Moves podcast. This week, we're speaking to Chris Fenning, a communications expert who's taught over 75,000 people practical and no-nonsense approaches to communication. He's worked together with organizations like Google, NATO, JP Morgan, and many others, and written multiple award-winning books, as well as ended up in the Harvard Business Review. We really enjoyed our conversation with Chris, and he really gave us some simple and actionable insights to build one of our most timeless and important skills. If you want to improve your communication for work and life in general, make sure you listen to this episode. We hope you enjoy the podcast.
All right, Chris, welcome to the show. Could you please introduce yourself and maybe following that, share what led to you focusing your career on communication?
Well, okay, straight in. Hi, I'm Chris Fenning. I teach communication skills. Think of me a little bit like Google Translate for techies talking to business people and also helping people be clear and concise in everyday communication. And the second part of the question was, how did I end up doing that? Well, in the beginning, how long can I make this answer? The journey to doing this was unusual. I think a lot of people who work for themselves end up with an unusual founder's story. And I spent 20 years employed. I was working for other companies around the world, six different industries. I think I'd worked in 20-something countries before I took the leap in my late 30s to doing this. And the reason for the change was I'd spent my entire career attending communication training that didn't really help me. A lot of communication training will tell you, you should do this thing, but they don't tell you how. And the answers tend to be quite vague. Well, it depends on this situation. It depends on that. And I got frustrated with not having very specific answers for how. And the reason for that is I'm an engineer by training. I like structure. I like formulas. Give me the sort of the ABC of how to do it. So when it came time to make a choice in my career and make a big change, I was going to work for myself. I ended up choosing communication because it is something that I've been doing through my whole life.
I think also the value of communication is really high. Like as Sebastian and I were preparing this episode, we were sitting down in the faculty, the business faculty, and these two janitors come up to the coffee machine. And once I said the other, communication is the most important thing we have. They were speaking about some kind of error that happened at work. And we thought, that's really funny that we're preparing for Chris. And then this little thing happens.
Coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah. So seeing your work revolves around communication, you see the value in it, right? You're selling the value effectively as well for your livelihood. So what makes communication so valuable?
So that statement, communication is the most important thing that we have. I agree in part. I don't like speaking in absolutes, because every situation is different. In some situations, communication is going to be the most important thing. In other situations, finding food is going to be the most important thing, or creating a nurturing relationship, or supporting someone, or achieving a work outcome. So it's not always the most important thing, but it's pretty high up there, and it's consistently an important thing. Because if we can't communicate, we can't get our message across, we can't demonstrate our value, we can't convince people of our ideas or share how we feel. And in terms of how important it is, there's a fantastic communications expert called Vin Yang. And he's got a very good description of why communication is important. And he says, if you are technically a 10, but your communication is a 3 in your ability, people are only going to see the 3. And people will judge you at the level of your communication, not your level of ability. Because if you can't communicate, you can't show people what you can do. You can't convince them of your ideas. You can't take the credit if someone else is trying to take that away from you. So it is really, really important. Not always the most important, but it's definitely an important thing for all of us at home and in our careers.
Of course. I was thinking of a follow-up, and I was thinking we didn't even really define communication. What is communication?
Oh, okay. I've got to make sure I don't go on my soapbox for this one. There's a typical description of what communication is. It's the delivery of a message and the receipt of a message. And there's a model that's described where you've got the sender and the receiver, and then there's a feedback mechanism, and then there's noise that gets in the way. And it's an often repeated model. And I don't agree that is communication. I agree that that's some of the mechanisms of how information passes from one person to another and gets confused. But I have a slightly different perspective on what communication is. Communication is a situation. It's a situation in which you are trying to convey something to someone else and have it received in the way that you want it. And every situation is different. Giving a status update to your boss, asking for something from a friend, venting after a challenging situation. Those are all different communication situations. So are talking to an executive, writing an email, negotiating, presenting, speaking on a stage, sitting in a podcast. All of these are different communication situations, and those situations require different techniques and methods to be combined to produce the outcome that you want. So what is communication? It's your ability to, or it is the act of conveying information from one person to one or more other people. And the success of that relies on your ability to perform in that specific situation.
You're also an author. And you wrote a book, The First Minute, which is all about improving the communication in the work environment. What is the general breakdown from the book? What is the most valuable lesson in that book actually for people to get better communication at work?
Okay, the most valuable thing from that book, and it's the place where we should all start our journey to improve communication, is it starts, as the title suggests, with the first minute. Take 10 seconds, 30 seconds if you're really feeling generous, and prepare for the start of a conversation you're having with a colleague, with a peer, with a fellow student, with your boss. Take a moment to prepare. Here's why. If you get the first minute wrong, you spend the next 5 to 10 minutes making up for that. If you are unclear at the beginning, you're going to have to revisit the conversation when the person you're talking to goes, sorry, what is it you need from me? Or what are we talking about? Oh, I thought we were talking about something else. We're talking about this. Oh, sorry, can we start again? All of those moments happen because we don't set up our conversations properly. And the takeaway from the book, and there are two models in the book. One is called framing. The other is called a GPS summary, how to summarize things. Those two methods give us the ability to set up and start a conversation that our audience is going to understand and pay attention to. And it takes less than a minute, usually less than 20 seconds, to be able to be to set up your audience to pay attention, to focus, and to understand.
Yeah, so it's really like the first impression. This is really important when you give a first impression to someone, but the first then 20 seconds of the conversation is just as important as that kind of builds up the first impression to give people as well.
Yes, it can.
Gets them like hooked.
Yep. First impressions are an entire topic area of themselves. There are people who make their entire careers just talking about first impressions. Mark Bowden in his TED talk and all of his material talks about that very first impression that you give. In his TED talk, he comes onto stage and he walks on and does this. So anyone watching on the video will see I'm raising my eyebrows. If you walk down the street and you know someone and you just give that little eyebrow flick, it instantly creates a connection of recognition, even if there isn't one between you already. People will go, oh, this person must know who I am. And that kind of first impression helps build connections, develop trust, will people listen to you, and so on. So there's a really millisecond first impression. The second type of first impression is the first time you meet someone in that first interaction, if it goes badly, that person's going to think badly of you. Let's say you'd received some bad news and then you were introduced to a new person in your study group or a new person in your team at work. And you just received some bad news, so you grumpily interacted with them and you didn't really pay attention to them, saying, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, hi, no, fine, I'll deal with you another time. That bad interaction will set up their first impression of you. If you are a really lovely person, it will still take you 7 more interactions to change that first impression. 7 more successful positive interactions in a row to change that first impression. The good news is, if this happens at work and it's someone in your team, you can overcome that within 24 hours. send an email, go say hi, meet them at lunch, have a chat with them on their desk. You can very quickly get to seven. If you only meet someone once a month, that's 7 months worth of good interactions.
Yeah.
So they're the first two types of first impression. When it comes to setting up the conversation based on the first minute, the first impression we give there, it's less about the impression of me and more about setting up the conversation and setting up you as the recipient of my message to understand what are we going to talk about, why are we talking about it, and why is it what's important, what do we want to happen next. That is less about an impression and more about getting you mentally in the right place to focus, pay attention, and have the rest of the conversation.
Yeah, I was going to relay some personal experience as well, because we were speaking briefly before we started recording about what Sebastian and I do next to this.
Yep.
And we spoke about my previous company, Disorder, where, you know, we'd have team meetings with 7 or 8 people, and you would start meetings, and I had to very quickly learn the value of clearly instantiating what it is that the goal of this meeting is, what we're going to do, the context, like not only verbally, but also in some other ways as well. And I think that it always set the tone. If I took the 20 seconds just to think about it, it does really help a lot.
Yeah.
And now that I'm working with other organizations, you can very quickly sense the improvised communication that occurs a lot. And you can very quickly delineate between the people who are, you know, winging on top of their shit, yeah, or the ones who are not.
Oh, yes.
And it does really influence the way that you communicate with those people. Because indeed, you said you're then backtracking for 5 minutes, trying to understand what they want. Or if you mess it up yourself, I've done this, you know, thousands of times myself as well. Backtracking on yourself, saying, no, I meant this because of that. And it's a very tiring and messy process.
Oh, yeah,
and it's not really like you resolve all the loose ends immediately. There can be unleft questions that are, you know, left unanswered.
Oh, and the more you try to unpack a conversation, the more you have to keep in your head mentally organize things, which is yeah, difficult.
Yeah.
We're talking about first impressions and the effort it takes. If someone's disorganized when talking to us, it can feel disrespectful. If someone comes in and says, hey, can I talk to you about a thing? And then they think out loud or just try and organize their thoughts as they come out of their mouth, that may be helpful for them, but it's really not a good, respectful use of my time. And at work, there are very few jobs where we've got loads of time just to sit around. You take your time getting to that point. I don't have a backlog of things to do. I mean, got an hour to kill here. It's not like that. We're always like moving on to the next thing. Time is important because we're under pressure. So if you're disorganized, it's disrespectful to me. You mentioned the meetings. There is a very simple thing that makes the biggest change to meetings. And this is part of a book that I've got coming out later this year, which is now called Effective Meetings, Great Results. Oh, the title changed this week. So it's Effective Meetings, Great Results, Less Pain Every Time.
Okay.
And the thing you can do at the beginning of your meeting, in fact, you should do it before you write the invitation, is to decide and identify what are the three things that define your meeting. What is the topic? What is the purpose? And what is the output you would like to produce from it? If you cannot say what those three things are, how can you plan the right activities? How can you invite the right people? How can you know whether you've succeeded in achieving what you need to in that meeting? So if you're bringing a group of people together and taking them away from their work, and you've got 5 people in a room for an hour, that's 5 hours worth of work, you better know the purpose. Like, what is the topic? What is the purpose? And what are we going to produce in that time?
Yeah.
Three things, TPO, put them in the invite, and then everybody else knows what the topic, purpose, and output are as well.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting, because with the work I do around organizational health, it's not very difficult, but it's about very simple and disciplined action that leads to these specific outcomes. And I think the worst part is that you only really experience the pain of those things when you're on the receiving end, usually.
There's a metaphor for business in general. It's not exciting stuff. It's simple, consistent application of easy things.
Absolutely. But I think that because it only really happens, or you only really notice it very clearly when you're on the receiving end, unless something goes very wrong, many people believe that they're actually good communicators or that their communication skills are fine. But until
it's
something
an other
goes
person
wrong.
Problem, right? Communication yes. is that. Oh, that's an other people problem.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The what is it? The fundamental distribution. No, fundamental misattribution error or fundamental attribution error, like a bias that we have.
Oh, yeah. It's not me. The other people are bad communicators. Yeah. And it's always, it's a them problem.
Exactly. For sure. Never me. Never me. Oh, I wonder what John said last week. I don't remember. What I said to him. I don't remember. Yeah. Anyway. But I think we're often so blind maybe to our own style of communicating and our own mistakes that we make. Mm. What are some of maybe, what are some of these very simple, actionable things that you were listing with your engineering brain, so to speak, that you've kind of now define as being useful to make sure that your communication is effective.
Mm. So what can people do? What do I do that really makes communication yes. effective? It's the simple stuff. Easy to say, hard to do, because you have to build the habits and practice these things. The first is have a bit of structure. Take a few seconds. You're about to talk to someone. Take a few seconds to work out what is the topic? What is the intent of this conversation? What is the point I want to make? If you're describing something, describe it in an organized way, not in a stream of consciousness way. And there are lots of different ways you can structure a message depending on the situation. I'm going to some of those if you'd like, but just know that there are simple structures, usually three-part structures, goal, problem, solution, before, during, after, short-term, medium-term, long-term, lots of three-part methods you can use to organize information so that your audience can really get it and interpret it more easily. So structure is the first thing. The second thing is perspective. And I don't believe this is talked about nearly enough. One of the biggest problems with communication, aside from the George Bernard Shaw quote, that the biggest problem with communication is the illusion that it's been accomplished, one of the reasons behind that is a great soundbite, and we all think we're great communicators, and the problem is other people haven't interpreted. It's their fault. It's a them problem. One of the challenges is we communicate from our perspective. We communicate knowing what's in our heads, and we have the information, the detail, the context, and we know why something's important to us. But the people we're talking to have no idea, and they don't have the same information, and they don't have the same perspective. I'll give an example of this. Politicians are great at this. Love them or hate them, but politicians are great at this. Let's say I was a politician and I wanted to come up, I was trying to get support for an education policy. I want to spend more money on education. If I have one line to describe why this education policy is important, that's not going to resonate with, it's not going to work for everybody. So if I'm talking to parents, I would say, this education policy is going to make sure your children are set up for success in the future that is coming. They will have the best possible start. That is from a parent's perspective. They're looking for what's best for their children. If I'm talking to someone in the finance department or the government budget or economics, that line isn't going to really convince them. Their perspective might be better addressed by saying, this policy is going to ensure that future workers earn more in our country and generate more tax revenue for us. Very different message. Say that to a parent. My kid is not just some future tax revenue for you. How dare you consider that? Different perspectives. I've given a fairly sort of broad and unusual example, but think about it at work. If I have an idea in my team and I want to convince my team to do something and my boss to do something, in my team, their perspective might be, what does it mean for us, for our time, and the work that we have to do? Mm. The boss might be interested in, what does it mean for the business? What does it mean financially or time-wise or in relation to customer satisfaction? Yep. So when we communicate, we have to consider a different perspective. So the first one was structure. The second one is perspective. Take a moment to think about the perspective of the people you're talking to or writing to and translate your message into something that makes sense and is understandable from their perspective. And that breaks down so many problems.
Hmm. I just want to talk about the structure again, because you mentioned how you as a communicator should make a structure of the message. Mm-hmm. But I want to flip that around, because I've had that very often that an employee comes to me and tries to give a message and it's completely unstructured. And when you then start kind of digging into that the communication from their part is bad, they go defensive. So it's really difficult to kind of tell someone this was really bad communication.
Yeah, don't tell people they suck and then say, but I'm going to help you make it better. That is a certainly way to get people's backs up.
Exactly. So how would you approach that? Because there's two sides to it, right? The person who delivers the message and the person who receives it. Mm. And the person who delivers it always thinks, my delivery was spot on. It's the receiver who received it completely wrong or completely didn't understand.
It's a them problem.
Exactly. but how would you communicate that structurally to someone that your structure is maybe a bit off here? It's not just me that receives it wrong. There's actually something fundamentally wrong in the message.
So there's two parts to this. The first part is you want to be able to understand their message. So you've got, how do I help get the clarity in what they're trying to talk to me about? The second part is, how do I deliver the feedback so that they can communicate better? The great thing is you can do this in a similar way. So if someone, one of your employees has come up to you and and it's your sort of stream of consciousness and they're just talking to you, you can use one of the frameworks that's in the first minute to help give them structure. And it starts with, how do you interrupt them? Well, just a little hand up. Put an hand up, open, palm out. This is just about the only bit of body language I teach. There's plenty of other people who are brilliant at teaching body language, but this is a really powerful move. It's a combination of stop. It's a very open palm means it's, I'm not attacking you. I'm being open. And it's also a little bit high school. Hey, I've got a question. So it's a combination of all three, but you're not putting your hand all the way up. It's just, hey, just pause for a moment. It's also the universal sign of hang on. Mm. And then you ask questions. Now, the framework in the book for starting a conversation is context, intent, and key message. Those could also be used, topic, intent, and point. It's a different way of thinking about it. And if someone doesn't start with those things, if they don't say, hey, can I talk to you about Project Everest? I need your help. I think we're going to be late next week. I'm looking to change our plan. That's a very clear introduction. Topic is Project Everest. Intent is, I need your help. The point is, I think we're going to be late. We need to change the plan. If they don't start with that, and you're just getting this big jumble of information, put your hand up and say, hey, sorry, can I just check something? Are we talking about Project Everest? Ask for the topic. Ask for the context. Then they fill that blank. Okay, great. Can I just check, is there something you need or want from me? Get them to answer the questions that you know you need. What are we talking about? Why are we talking about it? And what's your point? Then we can get into detail. Oh, great. Okay. And can I just summarize back what I'm hearing? It sounds like we need to change something in the plan for next week. Just want to make sure I got the point clear. You can ask for those things and you're changing it from a monologue where they're just going bleh, giving you all sorts of information, to a dialogue, which then means you've got that right to go back and forth and interject. By doing that, you're asking for what you need. You're helping them get organized, and so that conversation is going to be more effective. Once you've done that, you've also demonstrated how to be organized at the start of a conversation. You can finish that conversation, get the info you need. Now we move on to the second thing, which you asked about, how do you give the feedback? You can refer back to the demonstration of that conversation. Say, hey, just wanted to chat about the way we communicate at work. I want to help you as much as possible. I want to get the things you need quickly. Sometimes I struggle to know what it is that you want from me. So what would be really helpful is if you start a conversation and it's not pre-planned, could you just give me three things right off the bat? Could you just tell me what the topic is, tell me what you're after, and a headline, and then we can go into the detail. But that helps me pay attention and understand what you're after. So you're asking for something and you're asking for help. Human nature is people love to help. Like, oh, sure, I can help you. Oh, bless, you need help, sure. You're also demonstrating, you're saying they haven't done the thing that you'd like them to do. You're giving them a solution and you can refer back to that previous conversation, all without saying, you suck, do it differently.
Yeah, and that's the communication that happens a lot. It's the, you're wrong, you suck, do it differently. But I think approaching it this way as well will also help those unuseful conversations that last for 30 minutes, 40 minutes, where you're just sitting there trying to figure out what's going on. Because that happens a lot as well. The conversation that lasts for 30 minutes, they could be done in 10 minutes. We've noticed that when we started off having team meetings as well, that when we actually say from the beginning, this is what we're going to do, within an hour, we're done. When we don't say that, after 2 hours, we're looking at each other and we're we actually have other appointments as well that we need to make.
What did we achieve?
It doesn't help that Sebastian and I are friends, so we'll get lost in 10,000 other topics while we're there. So then if we don't set the frame, we just go everywhere.
Conversation deviation, going off on different tracks.
Yeah.
But knowing what you want to achieve in a conversation is not only going to get you more likely to get you the results that you want. If you want to ask your boss for time off, know that that's what you're going to do and tell them that's what you're going to do. Yeah. Don't go into the conversation and say, by the way, hey, boss, I want to let you know, I've got something going on at home at the moment. My aunt usually comes to walk our dogs, and she slipped and fell. She broke her arm. She's in the hospital. She's okay, but my dad has gone out to help look after her. And he usually arranges the dog walking and stuff, and we can't do that. And our dog's pretty sick at the moment. And you're probably both wondering, where am I going with this? Yeah. And what I'm wondering is, can I have next Thursday morning off just so I can get the dogs out and be fine? I've already arranged to get my work covered, etc. The actual point of the conversation is, hey, boss, can I talk to you about having next Thursday morning off? I can just explain why.
Yeah.
Get to the point quickly and then explain it. Otherwise, your audience is thinking, where is this going? And very quickly, they get frustrated. Why are you telling me this? Why are you making me work out what to do with all these bits of information? All irrelevant. Get to the point fast.
Very interesting. I think also that something that I'm wondering now, because I'm dealing with clients and then they're board members or executives, and you have to bring them ideas that they might disagree with. So how do you communicate these kinds of messages that are maybe pulling someone out of their perspective, and you're trying to show them a new one with a problem that they're dealing with?
Nice. How to change someone's perspective. You won't.
Okay.
We don't change our perspectives. Look at any country in the world with the political situation at the moment. It's always us and them. Think of things in our own lives where someone tries to convince you of something. They can come as logically as they like. You still believe your position. So you won't change someone's perspective. It's very unlikely. I said I wouldn't talk in absolutes. It's very hard and very unlikely to change someone's perspective. But you don't have to. So you're coming to an executive with an idea. You don't have to persuade them from your perspective. You have to connect your idea to their perspective. So I'll use an example to break this down. Let's say you've come up with an idea that will speed up a process within your team, but you're looking for an investment of $100,000 to make it happen. You're going to the executive and you say, our team can be faster. This is great. Our team will have less stress. We'll be able to get through the work quicker. It's going to cost $100,000. It's going to take 3 months to do, but our team is really going to benefit from this. Is the exec going to care? Probably not. Okay, what if I presented it this way? I have an idea to improve the efficiency in my team. What this means is we'll have 50% more capacity to do other things and other projects within the organization. It also means we'll complete this piece of work faster and customers will get the thing they want quicker, and that will improve customer satisfaction, which, by the way, generally means better customer retention, and it's easier to keep a customer than to pay to get a new one. I went second, third, fourth order effects, but what is the exec most likely to care about? The outcomes that are business related, financial related, customer satisfaction related. I'm not saying all executives are heartless and don't care about you and your team and stress and so on, but there are different priorities. They've got a company to run and keep functioning for all the other employees. So take your idea and express it in terms of three things, efforts, outcomes, and timeframes. Every idea, every process, every product, everything we do at work can be expressed and described in terms of efforts, outcomes, and timeframes. Yeah. It'll take this much time, money, resource, or energy to produce financial efficiency, speed, compliance, quality, safety outcomes, and we will do them now, next week, in a month. They'll last one day, a year, etc. Find the perspective your audience cares about. We talked about this earlier. And talk about those three things.
Mm. I think it's interesting because I've used the second part where you were talking about outcomes, efforts, and time frame, but not tying it to their perspective is where it's gone more wrong.
Yeah,
because I've done the second part and they're like, oh, that's really nice. But then if I don't tie it and link it, then they're like, sounds really nice. But then the intrinsic drive to then go do something with it is less.
But it's just not a priority right now. It sounds really nice, but I just don't care about it.
Yeah.
That's, if you want someone to care about your message, there's one thing that makes all of us care. And I'm going to tell you a story before I tell you what the thing is. There's one thing that makes all of us care. If you got a letter in the post or in the mail, and the letter was from your internet company, and it says, great news, internet speed is going to triple in your area. We're investing 50 million euros in upgrading the infrastructure. We have 10 teams out working night and day over the next 3 months to install new stuff. How much do you care about that?
I'd give a thumbs up and throw it away.
Yeah.
Okay. I like that you'd even give it a thumbs up. Most people go, oh, this is just trash. Away it goes. They don't care. What if you got a letter from them that said this? We're upgrading the internet in your area. Your road will be closed for 3 days next week while we dig it up. How much do you care now?
A lot.
What's the difference between those two?
One is an obstacle, the other one is a tool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And an obstacle, there's an impact, and there's an impact to you. The thing we pay attention to, the thing that makes us care, is an impact to something, either directly to us or to something we care a lot about. So if you want to make your messages resonate, if you want people to pay attention and understand and buy into your messages, connect it to an impact that they care about. Relevance and impact, it's the same word spelled differently. More relevant, more impact, more relevance.
Nice. I'll be using that.
I'll definitely use that as well.
It's such a powerful thing, but it's none of this stuff is complicated. And I get to say that I'm a satellite design engineer by training, so I'm a literal rocket scientist, or was. Don't get me to do rocket stuff now. This stuff isn't rocket science. It's simple stuff, but we're not taught it. And the really difficult thing is practicing it, remembering and applying. Because we spend the first 20 years of our lives being taught how to communicate socially, and we learn by example of the people around us. Mm. And we then go to work, and we're expected to communicate crisply, clearly, concisely, relevant. How do we make that shift from talking in a bar with your mates to updating an executive on an idea that could cost or save millions? That training gap is huge.
Yeah. Also, because we don't speak the same language around communication then, so we don't know how to even give feedback to other people about it, which is why Sebastian's question earlier was so useful, because I've always wondered as well inside my team, okay, how do I give you feedback on your communication, but am I communicating that effectively? Because I don't even know the bits and pieces that I need. Yeah, so I'm just like, how can we untie all of these weird ends together? Because if you don't even understand what you're talking about that well, and you don't know how to do it because you've never been taught it, then you can't improve it either.
That's true. So there are two ways, lots of ways, but I believe there are two broad ways to improve communication. One is to study, go and research and study and learn about the methods and techniques for the particular communication situation that you want to improve. So way back at the start, I talked about communication situations. If you want to get better in meetings, go and learn how to be better in meetings. Don't go and learn public speaking, because that's not going to help you in a meeting as much as getting organized and learning how to keep things on track, time management, etc. So pick a situation you want to improve and go and learn what the techniques and methods are for that situation. The second thing is talk to people. You both have teams. You've mentioned teams multiple times. Go and ask how they would like to be communicated with. But don't ask that in a very broad question, because it's difficult to answer. Get specific and say, if I'm coming to you with an urgent request, is there a way in which you'd prefer that I do that? Do you want me to send you an email with details first and then have a conversation? Do you want me to talk about the whole thing and then you ask questions? Like, what do they prefer? What are their preferences? And this is the key to many communication problems, cross-culturally, globally, virtual teams, and so on. Communicating in the style that the recipient likes, is going to make your communication more effective. The trouble is that takes time and effort, and we want to do it our way.
Yeah.
But that, if you communicate in the way that other people like to be communicated with, that's going to solve some problems. So if you're the boss of a team, talk to your team individually and find out what their individual preferences are, and then adapt a bit. You don't know when I have to have seven very different conversations to deliver the same message. But at least if you're aware of them, in the high stress, high intensity situations, you can adapt to make it easier and more effective for the people that you're with.
I wanted to ask as well, like now we talk about communication in person, how you would do this. After COVID, a lot of the team work has actually switched to a hybrid method. So some meetings you have three people sitting in a meeting room and three people online or four people online and sometimes vice versa. And what I'm doing right now as well, it's a lot of meeting with investors, but it's people from the US, Asia, Africa, from around where you're doing everything online. Is the communication tools to use then for effective communication the same as you would do in person, or do they change a bit?
So the basic rules of their perspective, make it relevant to them, be structured, they stay the same no matter what the medium. That works in email, face-to-face, video. Those things stay the same. If you get those right, you're streets ahead of everyone else that you're working with. You will stand out as a good communicator. But there are some differences. But the differences aren't so much in the methods you use. It's the differences, particularly video. So let's say Zoom or other tools are available. If you are on a video call with someone, it takes more effort and energy. It takes more concentration on elements that you don't have to pay attention to as much in person. So we're sat across the table from each other. I can, while I'm looking in your eyes, I can still see what you're doing with your hands. I can see your body language. Not everyone can read body language, but at a general rule, we can tell if I'm sat here like this, I'm leaning forwards with my fists on the table, my body language is aggressive to you. Anyone listening to this in the podcast is probably hearing my voice is pretty much the same, but my body language is not happy. Whereas now if I lean back in my chair and I'm all relaxed, I'm very unprofessional. You can see that even when you're looking in my eyes. On a video screen, you're limited. You don't see as much of the body. You can't tell what someone's doing. And it's made worse by the fact that we look at faces, we don't look at cameras. So what we see on a video call is somebody looking off to the side and typing. Well, are they taking notes or are they just answering an email or looking up, like reading the news? Yeah. So all of the things that we are used to in person, we have to pay more attention and more effort to online. You have to pay attention. You have to look at the body language. You have to start to ask, I got the sense that you might have, I might not have been clear. Again, not saying, oh, you're confused. It's saying, I might not have been clear. Is there something you'd like me to clarify? Paying attention to where their focus is. Are they drifting? Those make it harder to communicate. So we have to put more effort into the things that we do subconsciously. This is all assuming people pay attention to those things anyway. And I have a big bias in that I do pay attention to it. It's part of my job. But we can all tell if someone's engaged or not. If we're paying a little bit of attention in person, you have to pay a lot more attention online.
I also wanted to bring this to the home front. How do you take all these techniques then to having a conversation with your loved ones at home?
That is a really great question for another guest. there's a TV show from a while ago called The West Wing, which is a US political show. And in one of the episodes, one of the main characters decided to try and fix Social Security. And there's a line that said, Social Security is the third rail. Touch it and you die. And for anyone who doesn't know what the third rail is, trains run on two rails next to each other. The power can come from the third rail next to it. Don't touch the electric one. In my line of work, for me personally, that is the third rail. I'm not a relationship communications expert. I could use some help in my own. Mm-hmm. My wife, I love my wife dearly. She puts up with me. Thank you. I'm very grateful for putting up with me. There's lots of great people who can provide relationship advice. That's my official line. I have been told that some of the methods that I teach are helpful at home and in some unusual situations, but I'm not qualified to say that.
Yeah, fair enough.
But the examples that I've had, one that really sticks with me is a center that works with families where the parents and the children, the children have behavioral challenges or they're somewhere on the autism spectrum, and the communication between the parents and the children is very challenging. And there's a center that works with families, and they use the methods from the first minute because it takes out the emotion and it helps people structure a message. And in that situation, not being angry or emotional can be very helpful to structure and organize a message so that it's received. My wife will often say, if you topic intent point me one more time, if you go problem solution me, don't you dare. Because we're having an emotional conversation. Yeah, if I come in with rigid logic, that's not a great fit.
Yeah.
But if you're struggling, so this is the one tip I will give. If you're struggling to organize your thoughts, find a structure that helps you organize them without the emotion, and then go and read a book from an emotional expert as to how you can deliver it with care, love, and feeling, which is less necessary in the workplace.
Yeah. And that's the difference between those as well, right? The emotional part is much higher at home, obviously, than at the workplace.
It can be. But I think this is a great misconception that I had for when I became a manager. I think, well, work and like who I am at home and who I am at work are different. And it's not true. We're humans. We're humans wherever we are. And we are driven by our emotions. We react emotionally first and justify logically second. Buy a car. You pick the car you really want, and then you justify why it's so good to fit in around your life. Most people do that. So we aren't completely separate. One of the differences at work is so much of the communication is transactional. Trying to do this thing, need to meet this deadline, need to do that. We have that at home. Buying groceries, planning a vacation, managing life and a house and schedules. That's still transactional. Yeah. But you also have the love of your life and the pain in the ass dog that you've got, or whatever it happens to be. I love my dog very much. I wasn't projecting. But so we have, where was I going with this? I've lost my, I got distracted by my own dog there. So we are human. We have the emotions first. There's just a lot more of them at home.
Yeah.
But don't anyone listening to this, don't think that when you're at work, you turn the emotions off.
Mm-hmm.
You don't. You do need to be aware of the impact they have on others. And it just takes a bit more consideration in that professional style environment.
Yeah. For me, it's a very useful feedback tool, actually, emotions and things like this, in terms of just understanding how I react to situations. I remember there was a situation where we had worked months on a new clothing collection in the Side Disorder, and the design team presented it to us. And we were like, wow, this looks amazing. But there was just a slight off feeling in myself, and I kind of started to feel in the entire room. And it was the colors, and they were wrong. I mean, it's just colors. But we all felt kind of like, eh. And then just listening to that emotion and then being able to deliver the message on the flip side in terms of why am I feeling this, understanding it and investigating it, and then realizing it was because of also still rational reasons. It was completely the wrong colors for the season, for the message we were bringing across. And then being able to articulate it from an emotional reaction actually turned into the design team within the next few hours, turning it around, ordering the prototypes, and then it being the most successful collection we ever had.
Nice. Self-awareness, that gut feel. There's quite a few studies about gut feel is your body working faster than your brain, the conscious brain. And listen to your gut. But the most important thing that I took from your story there is pausing. Recognizing and pausing. Something is happening in me and you have a choice. Do you just let that thing happen, particularly with anger or frustration? Or do you pause? And pausing is almost always the best course of action. It only needs to be a second, but just catch yourself before that big immediate response. Oh, that's really dumb. Oh, I shouldn't say that to my boss. Or I shouldn't say it to anyone, really. But take that moment. You're going to have a reaction. And this takes a lot of practice and a lot of effort and self-awareness over time. And usually the learning happens after a bad event. After that time you blew up or you said the thing, your mouth worked faster than your brain's stop lever can be pulled and the thing comes out of your mouth. And then, looking back, I realized I could feel I was getting a little bit tense. And learning from those moments and consciously being aware of, okay, I'm having a feeling. Pause, engage brain, and then speak. It's really hard to do. Very easy to sit here and say, but it is an incredibly long time and lots of practice and repetition to get that right.
Yeah, and I think not only is it most often the right course of action, like you said, I think importantly, it also never really hurts.
There's no risk to taking a 2 second pause.
No.
You know, so.
No.
Just do it.
How dare you think about your answer before responding to me? Come on, I want instant responses right now.
I mean, that's the way people think, to be fair, or at least very improvised.
It is. But then it's like working with a bunch of 4 or 5 year olds. Mm. Not in their mental capacity, but in the just whatever is in their head comes out of their mouths. Yeah. Mm. And this dinner sucks, Mum. Oh, wouldn't say that. Dad, you built that wonky. Yes, it did. Or Mum built it wonky, or Dad cooked it wrong. It could go either way.
Yeah. I was wondering, because when you were listing your like the structures that and the shape they can take, you said it often comes in threes. And it made me think of narrative, because that also usually comes in Act 1, Act 2, and Act 3. And people often stress the importance of narrative in communication. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the example you gave with, you know, my aunt, she got hurt, can't walk the dog, and take Thursday off, yada, yada, yada. People can say, oh, that's also narrative, but it's very messy. And maybe it's not even really a story, it's just blabbing. So question one is, how do you see the role of narrative in communication in the workplace? Let's start there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Narrative and details are different. Narrative is a structure. Mm. We talk about three-part structures. It's important. Detail can get in the way of narrative. Too much detail is confusing. It's overwhelming. It takes away from the key points. So how do I see narrative in the workplace? I'm going to start by saying what we don't or shouldn't need to do. There's a big push at the moment of learning business storytelling. Storytelling is important. Again, just like public speaking isn't the first thing you should learn, business storytelling is not the most helpful thing to learn. You can tell a story in 3 lines. Storytelling doesn't require... I'm going to go back a moment. Business storytelling is hinged in things like the hero's journey, which is the full character arc you see in books and films, and the structure of a true story, how to bring people in, how to hook them, how to create suspense. No one wants suspense at work. Don't go into a meeting, and no one wants a story in a meeting that goes, once upon a time, like, oh, you better get to the point fast. Nobody wants that. And the suspense isn't exciting and drawn in. That works in films and books. But suspense at work is, what does this mean for me? What are the consequences? And I'm either going to stop paying attention because I don't care about the suspense, or I'm going to get the really wrong idea of what's coming. So a lot of the story mechanics and business storytelling and getting people excited are not helpful for day-to-day communication. Yes, if you're the CEO giving a keynote speech at the annual event, storytelling is important, but that's not what most of us do. But narrative is critical, and narrative comes in these frameworks. I've mentioned something from the first minute, which is goal, problem, solution. That's a narrative structure. It's a story structure. And I can use it for giving an update, presenting an idea, answering an interview question. Here's an example. Hey, boss, we're trying to deliver the new software release by next Thursday. That's our goal. The problem is the main developer is out sick for this week. What I'd like to do to solve this is bring in 2 people from a different team. Mm. Or what I'd like to do to solve this is, can we have an extension for another week? Or et cetera, et cetera. But I've told a story. I've told a story that we're trying to achieve this. Here is the problem, and this is the solution. And that narrative avoids one of the most common and frustrating conversation situations that we face, which is a backwards conversation. And a backwards conversation goes like this. Someone in your team comes up to you and says, hey, can I have your approval to buy this thing? And the question that you have in your mind is, why? Why do I need this? Like, feel free to speak up. It's a podcast.
What? Whoa.
Interactive, guys. Why? Oh, well, because we're trying to solve this thing over here. Well, why is that important? Oh, because we're trying to get to here. So I've come in asking for something. And what we've done is we've moved further and further into the past, away from the thing that I want. Whereas if I begin with, hey, our goal is to achieve this thing. We're trying to do this by next Friday. The problem we're facing is this. Can I have approval to spend that?
Right.
I've told you a story, where we're going, problem, what we're going to do about it. Mm. I've given you a narrative, and we've not gone backwards. I've led you to the point that I want, which is then, okay, you've got some questions about how much and when, et cetera. Mm. But we're now talking about the solution, not why we need it. Mm. And that is the power of narrative.
Yeah. And you're operating then in the present where you can make decisions. You can't make decisions in the past. So if you keep taking it back further and further and further, you feel like you've lost influence or control. And you're thinking, okay, well, why the hell did that happen in the first place?
Yep. Oh, and then you start unpacking. Well, why was that a problem? Who did it? What caused it?
Yeah.
And you start digging into the history. Whereas, who cares?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, maybe someone's care that if there's a really big problem. But generally speaking, we want to understand why we're being asked to do a thing or for permission for a thing. Right. So give it to them. Mm. We're trying to go over there. There's a problem. I have an idea for a solution. Is it okay if we do that?
Yeah. And even in that instance, it just helps you execute faster. So even if it was a massive crisis situation, actually not even, then it's even more important that you handle something quicker. And then you can do a post-mortem afterwards.
Oh,
you
know,
right? And then break it down and ask the why questions 6-7 times, however many times you want to do it.
Talking about risks and issues, giving updates, something's on fire, there's a massive problem on our project.
Yeah.
Okay, again, we could have set up the conversation. Hey, I need to talk to you about our project. I need to give you a heads up on a problem. The point is, we're going to be late for this, or we need more money, or something has happened. Yeah. Let me give you a quick summary of what's happened. We're trying to achieve this thing. We've experienced a couple of problems. Here's what they are at a high level. Here's what we are going to do about it or would like to do about it. You've guided people to a future-focused conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the more critical, the more urgent the thing is, the less you want to have like opening the box and pulling all the wires out, what's going on. You just want to, let's talk about the solution.
Yeah. And for the listeners, that's also in a Harvard Business Review article. I think you wrote about the same process.
I did. Good research.
As we do. So you can refer back to that as well. It's very useful. And I think it's something that I've also thinking of started to apply, and I think it would have helped with my team if they came to me with something rather than pulling me into the past where I can't think straight anymore.
Yeah.
Because it becomes conflated with a bunch of different information. So
it does. So let's go back to the question you said earlier. How do I help other people improve their conversation to avoid the you suck, do it this way? Demonstrate it and give your team the tools to communicate with you in the way that you need.
Yeah.
And you can do this with little scripts if they're, depending on their level of professionalism, how far they are in their careers, how open they are to receiving written instructions. But whether it's written or verbal, you could say, hey, if you're coming to me with an issue, what would be really helpful is, can you give me these three things up front in this order? And it doesn't matter if you deliver them as bullet points, that will really help me get my head in the right space to listen to the rest of it. Is that something you can do?
No.
And then once you've asked them to do that, the next time they come with an issue, if they're verbal diarrhea-ing, you can say, hang on, just can you give me those three things we talked about a little bit before? Can you just tell me X, Y, and Z?
Yeah.
What is the goal, problem, the solution? What is the whatever your structure is going to be? And then you've asked them for it, and you've also told them how to succeed. If you want my attention, and I want to be as helpful as I can to my team. So to do that and to help get my head out of the 100 other things that I might be thinking about, if you can just hit me with these three bullet points, I'll be lasered in on what you want. And then I'll be more able to help with your situation.
So, Chris, we've spoken a lot about your work. And a lot of our audience is on the younger side. And I think they're still trying to kind of find their path. And you've landed in quite a unique self-employed position with the work that you do. So what kind of advice would you kind of give to maybe your younger self or other young people in terms of kind of finding your own path?
Finding a path. Well, I never knew what I wanted to do when I grew up, and I was 37 when I started making real choices to land where I am now. So the advice to anyone starting out is any decision you make is not final. You're not locked into anything. I worked in 6 different industries in multiple countries, and I now do something that is about as far removed from aerospace and satellite design than you can get. Maybe acting would be a little further, maybe makeup. But you can go. Any decision you make is not permanent. So experiment. Experiment, find what you like, find what works, find what doesn't, learn from it, and then do the next experiment. And that might mean working in a job that sucks for a while, that isn't your dream job. But as long as that job is teaching you particular skills or competencies, giving you an opportunity to learn and develop, or giving you the finances so that you can do the things you want on the side, then you're heading in the right direction. There's a really good book called Designing Your Life. And I forget the author's name. They're two professors from Stanford University. And it's the most popular program at Stanford, and it helps students identify what they want to do and what would make them happy, what they believe would make them happy in their lives. And there's a whole thing of coming up with a vision board of the next few years. And then the most important piece of advice that I took away from this was go and find out. If you think you want to go run a restaurant, go and talk to people who run restaurants and ask them what it's like. And your dream of being out front and interacting with customers may actually be an administrative nightmare where you're stuck in a back office dealing with late orders all the time. Go and find out. Go and work in a restaurant. My dad gave me a piece of advice repeatedly for many years, and I eventually listened to it. He said, don't just talk about doing something. Go and do it. If you want to be a pilot, go and pay for one private flying lesson. You might hate flying, but don't live with this dream of becoming a pilot and doing nothing about it. Go and take the first step and find out if it's real. To come full circle, experiment. Your decisions are not permanent. You're not locked in. Have an idea. Go and try it out. If it doesn't work out, have another idea.
Yep. I think that's very valuable to say also that the study you do doesn't define you. I have a lot of friends who are looking for jobs and then they come back and saying, there's nothing for me to find because I'm only looking for this because this is what I studied. But with that study, you can do X, Y, and Z extra as well, or take another job or do something completely unrelated to what you studied because you're still qualified for doing it.
Yes.
And that's what a lot of people miss to see in the opportunities that there are around.
Yep. There's topic knowledge and topic expertise, and then there's competencies.
Yeah.
Your ability... communication, run meetings, solve problems, those are transferable competencies. And the image of a career being a ladder is very 1950. Yeah. That's 75 years ago, mm-hmm. Which is scary to say because it didn't feel that long ago. But that's very 1950. Now it's a lattice. You can move up and across. And I know a lot of people, and I've done this myself, who've moved backwards in terms of career position. It's not always become a junior, then an intermediate, then a senior, then an executive. You can move down a rung to move across into a different industry. Yeah. And that is still valuable. If it takes you where you want to go, we think short term, and we shouldn't. We should think long term, and long term isn't just one long line. It's lots of very small steps that go in all sorts of different directions. Yeah. So we're not locked into what we study. Here's as an example through my career, I studied aerospace, aeronautics and astronautics in the UK. And I went to work for a defense company. And within a year, I was doing business stuff for the defense company. I then worked for a telecoms company and then a travel company and then an internet company and then a healthcare company that was an insurance company. And now I teach communication skills. That's not an obvious linear path. Mm. But every single job made a lot of sense moving from one to the other. It just wasn't a straight line to becoming the person who designed satellites at NASA.
Exactly. And I think the thing is that you have to live life very much in a forward-facing direction, which is why those changes make sense in that moment. But only does it really make sense in retrospect, at least when you zoom out. That's what I had with my past projects and ventures and things like this. I was like, how the hell did I end up here? And then I look back and I'm like, oh, that connected to this and this connected to that. And that would allow me to build those skills, which then got me here. And therefore, I like what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
Right? And it's all that experimentation. I think with the restaurant, I have a very specific one. I wanted to open my own restaurant. I was obsessed with the Netflix show Chef's Table when I was a teenager. I was cooking all these fancy things at home. And I told my parents, I want to go to culinary school in France and do that. And it was like absurd amounts of money. You know, like the best culinary school there is, of course, like, let me go do that. They said, go work in the restaurant next door first and see how you like it.
Wise parents.
Yes, very wise. I now prefer to eat at restaurants and I will probably never want to work or own in one unless I have absurd amount of money where I can just run it without having any worries.
Nice.
It's not made for me.
What a great, not made for you. Yeah. That is, understanding what we don't like and being able to admit it is so important. I had an interview question in a job. This was pretty late in my employed career where I was asked, what would you not be good at? And I'm fairly confident / arrogant. And of course, I could do anything, except I couldn't be a dance instructor. I'm not very good at dancing or singing and so on. So I came up with some answers that were good enough to get the job. But in hindsight, not only should I realize that I'm not very good at everything, but I don't like everything. That's the most important thing. And I'm just sticking with restaurants and giving them a bit of a bashing, but I don't like having to pay incredible detail to every temperature and amount of time that every piece of food, working under incredible pressure where somebody, just because they're having a bad day, says they don't like the food, and doing that in antisocial hours. I don't like those things. Could I do it? Yes, I've actually been a chef's assistant in a restaurant and done that stuff, but I didn't enjoy it. So recognizing what we like and don't like, going and working, you worked in a restaurant and went, oh no, I don't like this. I'd rather eat the stuff. Own it and have confidence owning what you like and don't like. Because the sooner you get to the point that you can say, oh, I don't like doing that, well, then that's a whole area you don't have to worry about, think about, you know what to avoid. When people say, oh, there's a great opportunity in this space. Like, brilliant, great opportunity for someone else.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think otherwise you always go through your life with what if, which then maybe breeds artificial regrets that would have never been regrets in the first place because you didn't try.
There's a whole podcast episode there.
That's for another time. Yes. Chris, I mean, you know, we ask all our guests to bring an object or maybe two of personal significance. What did you bring today and why?
I brought two. Thank you for giving me that out. I've brought with me two very small carved stone statues. I'll hold them up. I don't know how well they will come up on the camera. One is a tortoise and the other is a hare. And the Aesop's fable of the tortoise and the hare and the race and the tortoise won by being slow and steady. These sit on my desk. I have very little on my desk other than paper when I'm working on stuff. These are the two of the only items I have. And my natural tendency is to be the hare. Rush in, there's a thing, go ahead, rush. But I know that careful planning and detail makes a big difference in the end. So the tortoise is there to remind me I should be more like the tortoise. I'm not ignoring the hare, but it helps me remind me that sometimes I need to overcome my natural tendency to rush and take that slow, steady approach. And I'd like to say it's been helpful. They add a bit of color and variety to my desk, but it is a useful reminder for me. And my biggest successes have come from steady and not from rushing.
Yeah. So slow and steady wins the race.
It really does. To coin a phrase, it really, really does. Someone said that once before, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. Story in it.
Yeah. It sounds familiar.
Yeah.
I mean, I think for me, though, it's also context dependent, like the communication we spoke about on the situation. Because I think the best situation for me is being a turtle at the beginning. And once I figured it out, then I can be a hare and just go.
You can go faster.
Yeah.
It's the don't rush in.
Yes.
Yes.
And don't be arrogant and fall asleep under a tree believing that you're going to win a race.
Also.
Less generally applicable to my day-to-day life, but.
Yeah, fair.
Still some business lessons in there as well.
Yeah. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Chris. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it today. A lot of insights and a lot of puzzle pieces clicking, I think.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me in. It's been a really enjoyable conversation.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to our episode. If you want to connect with our guests personally, then give us a follow on LinkedIn at First Moves. We also have an Instagram at First Moves Podcast. And lastly, we ask you to leave a review. This will enable us to bring better guests on board and give you better content in the future. Have a nice day.